These are the people at the heart of racing. Their lives, their stories, in their own words.
Yeah, racing. I mean, that's where it started, Michael. That's really the beginning. That's where it burned as a kid.
We'll talk about the champion, Black Caviar.
Black Caviar was a freak. So was the trainer.
No, the first Melbourne Cup I was involved with was a horse called Gutum Gutum.
Gutum Gutum.
I was listening to an RSN interview with John Hawkes, and he said, I think it's a really average guineas this year.
This is a very sad story, but making sure that, you know, that his head was upright.
See TJ Smith or Bart Cummings in the background, and you're just in awe.
Follow a lot of sports, but the sport I'll follow most closely will be horse racing.
For the next hour, RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents Racing's Open Mic.
Welcome to a special edition of Racing's Open Mic. Gee, we've had some legends in the studio, both from the racing world and general sporting world, including Bruce McAvaney and Drew Morfitt. And I think we have just completed the trifecta when it comes to the best sports broadcasters the country has seen in recent years, because a good friend of mine, Sandy Roberts, has joined me in the studio. How are you, Sandals?
Mick, good to be with you. Great to be with you, in fact, here in the Salubrious Studios.
You know radio very well, but you've never actually been here to RSN 927 or 3UZ.
No, this was the old UZ, the greater.
That's it.
The greater, 3UZ.
Well, you've done a lot on radio and television, but gee, you've got a lot of media exposure over the past couple of days.
Mick, I'm looking forward to having a quiet day.
You officially have decided to retire from television. We'll still hear your dulcet tones calling one footy match a week. But after 46 years, why did you decide to pull the pin?
It's something that my wife, Carolyn, and I have been discussing for a while. My contract expired at the end of the year with Fox, and we thought, despite being offered another 2 years, we were both very conscious. We are very conscious of not overstaying your welcome, not becoming a burden or an embarrassment, and you're far better off getting out when you think you're still pretty well on top of things than, as I said, becoming somewhat of an embarrassment.
Well, you can rest assured that is certainly not the case. What a remarkable career you've had. You've called over 1,100 matches of football, 11 Olympic Games, 25 years of golf, tennis, racing. I know you've got a great love of racing. We're going to talk about some of the horses you've owned and some of the big racing moments. And probably your most infamous moment was on a racetrack at Mount Gambier. We'll get to that a little later.
Thank you, Michael.
As well. But where did it all begin for you? Because you were born in South Australia.
Yeah, came from a farm in a little town called Lucendale, some 250 miles in those days, southeast of Adelaide. And Lucendale wasn't a big place, but it did produce one very good footballer who came over here. He was, I think he wore number 24 for Essendon. His name was Stephen Copping.
Wow.
And was best known. He had these long, we call them elastic arms. He was extraordinary. So, yes, that was Lucendale. Then went to school in Adelaide. Left school and thought, what will I do? I managed to get a job as a copy boy for News Limited in Adelaide. However, the Murdoch family decided after I'd been there for a year that we won't have copy boys anymore. So that was the end of that short career. So then I jumped on a train and decided to go to Perth just to see what it offered. Jumped off the train, walked down St. George's Terrace, which was the main street, saw a sign 6 p.m. and some steps going down, and I figured that's a radio station. So I went in and said, yeah, look, I was a cadet. I sort of put a bit of
upgraded
mail on it from Adelaide, and just looking for a job. Yeah, well, come in, yes, if you'd like to go into that booth and take these scripts with you. Yep, no problem. So then I started there. I got the job, and next week I was in there, and I left the newsroom one day, and I walked in past the studio, and there playing his platters and ad-libbing away was none other than Dennis Cometti.
It's remarkable. That's how long you and Dennis go back.
Yeah,
to
yeah. Met. So he was a rocky jockey, and I was a news journo.
And where you both ended up, sitting next to each other calling grand finals.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Was Dennis, he's a little bit eccentric, we know that. What was he like back in the young days?
Yeah, he was, he was a rocky jockey. Well, hi, everybody. You're on 6 p.m., the pleasure machine. But he was, you know, Dennis is Dennis. We all know him. As you say, he can be a little bit eccentric, but no, we got on really well.
And where did your love of actual calling sport come from? Was that something that you were always wanted to get into?
I don't know that it was, Michael, initially. I loved radio and I loved music. So what I'd do at the end of my journo shift at 6 p.m, I'd go into a studio up the back and I'd sit down with a pile of records and do tapes, you know, thinking that, well, yes, I'll be a radio announcer one day. I'll follow Dennis. And ironically, that's what happened when I left Perth and I went overseas for a year or so and I came back. I had to get a job and so I still had the tapes. So I sent them off everywhere and lo and behold, I got a job at 3CS in Colac.
Wow.
And went down there. Who was doing breakfast? Greg Evans.
Really?
From Blind Date days, yes. So I had a most enjoyable time at 3CS and from there to BCV8, which was my first stint in television.
And was that back in South Australia or was that here in Victoria? Because did you start your first stint on TV?
No, here in Victoria, BCV8, Bendigo.
And was that presenting?
That was, look, when you're an announcer in country television, you do everything. Mm. You, I mean literally everything. I'll give you an example. I had to go and do a commercial for the Bendigo Motor Company, which was a car company in Bendigo. When you, I say, don't go and do a commercial, you write the commercial, you go out to the wherever they are with a crew and film it, you come back, you edit it, then you have to put the voice down, so you put a tape on the video machine, you press record, sprint into the voice booth with your script, read it, then belt out once again and turn off the videotape, and there you have your commercial. So it was a great way of learning. It was fantastic. So I think that really did help me understand television. And from there, I went to Adelaide on a holiday and went into ADS 7 and did an audition there, which I thought I absolutely stuffed up. I remember I had to read some scripts for selling vegetables. And I thought, I was so depressed after I'd read it. I thought, oh, no, I've buggered this up. Anyway, I got the job. And I started there as a general announcer, which was marginally better than being a general announcer in BCV8. And did things like hosting movies, the midday movie and a number of things. And then they eased me into news and sport, and it just sort of grew from there. And from there, doing reserves football in the Sandful, and then into the senior footy, and was at ADS for 7 years, which was a most enjoyable time.
I want to talk about your football commentating, but before we go into some of the great calls that you've had and all of that, there's a great linkage between yourself and commentators of your ilk and the great race callers that we see, like Matty Hill at the moment and Bill Collins, who you spent a lot of time with. But your recall of colours, numbers, names, how much did you study? And are you a bit like a Matty Hill or a Bill Collins? You have a great short-term memory recollection?
That's an interesting question. Many people learn it in different ways. I don't think that I had a telegraphic memory or anything like that. I think it's just, it's hard work. And you've just got to put your head down and your bum up and learn the way they run, the way they move, what they look like. Because if you're on a wet day and you're particularly, say, out at Waverley where it rained just about every day at VFL Park, in those days, and if you're seeing two players running for a ball on the outer side in the wet and running laterally so you can't see their numbers or what they look like, it's darn hard to call them. So you've just got to, it's a matter of, you know, you sit down, you do a pre-season, you sit down and you go through. What I do is I know basically the clubs that I'm going to be looking at, say, for the first 4-6 weeks. So I will fastidiously go through their squad, each squad, and basically learn everyone.
Did you ever try to call a race?
I don't think I could. See, I think calling racing is much harder than calling football. Mm. Now, race callers might say the other way around, but no. And to do it, I know it's the colours that are so important in racing, but for a race caller, if there's a 7 or 8 event card, and to be able to sit down, do race one, you know, that to me is like calling a game. But yeah. Then he's backed up 25 minutes later for race two and goes all the way through until 5 o'clock. That is a really, I really admire race callers. I think they do a mighty job.
You've called with some of the greats and you worked with Bill Collins, Bruce McAvaney. Who do you think is the greatest commentator that you've worked with?
Well, I was influenced, Michael, in the very early days by Butch Gale, who was very good, Ted Whitten, Mike Williamson. Now, those three had one thing in common. They were callers, but they were also entertainers. Mm. They wanted to entertain. And I've always felt that is a part of being a football commentator. I know it's big business, but it's sport, and sport is entertainment, and we should be entertaining. So they were very influential, particularly working with Louis and Bob Skilton early on in the Army Reserve Cup, and then things just went downhill after Don Scott and Peter McKenna came along. But again, that was entertainment. I mean, Ron Casey would come in on a Monday morning. Ron, for those who didn't know, was the general manager of Channel 7 and a wonderful man. And he'd come in and he'd say to Gordon Bennett and Gary Fenton, who are in charge of sport, "Oh, what have those three clowns done to me now on Sunday afternoon?" But the thing was, it rated.
Yeah.
And it gained a cult following. And the game itself almost became a minor part of the afternoon, if you like. Now, you know, some people mightn't like me saying that, but that's probably what it was. It was just a way to get through the afternoon with a footy match and have a bit of fun at the same time.
And the entertainment in your calls is what you'll be remembered for, especially some of the bigger moments and how you describe them. Here's some of Sandy's highlights from more than 1,100 games of AFL.
MCG is on fire. There are sparks flying. Those flames are really blowing into the night now. This scoreboard could explode.
What an unbelievable experience that night would have been. But those, yeah.
That, Michael, was extraordinary because that fire, I noticed at approximately 7:29 p.m. Our coverage on 7 began at 7:30. So we'd, as you know, you get given your running sheet and you know exactly what's going on at what time and whatever. So I see this fire on the scoreboard at 7:29 and I say through to the producer, who I won't name, I said, look, you're not going to believe this, but the scoreboard's on fire. Yeah, don't worry about that now. We're coming up to the opener, okay? Just stand by. So eventually, when the fire did get worse, he did realise that, yes, we should actually forget the running sheet for the moment and concentrate on the fire. But, yeah, that was extraordinary.
You've been behind the microphone for some unbelievable moments. Those calls, some of the biggest moments that you've, I suppose, covered, when it all occurs, how instinctive is it? We talked to some race callers about, I've got a line for a big race just there that I can pull out, but I can't see how you could possibly have that.
No. The one that I was probably a little fortunate with was Gary Ablett, who I loved watching. He was my favourite player. And I basically took a punt that he was going to kick the goal because I said, what more can you say before the ball had gone through the goals? Mm. So if it had gone through from behind, I would have looked a fair idiot. But thankfully it did. No, you... Some people do actually have lines that they set up and want to use. But no, I just go with the flow, and if it happens, it happens. And you know, anything that's good or you know, brilliant or rare, you're going to get excited about. So you know, you can't falsify that excitement. So that's the way I've always gone.
19 grand finals included in 1,100 matches. What's your most memorable call?
Oh, I think it's usually in most things, it's the first time you've done it. So I'd hosted grand finals for probably 8 or 9 years before I got the chance to call my first one, which was 1990 Collingwood Essendon. Essendon went in red hot favourites, and Collingwood kept them to 6 goals, and we had the Barney with Gavin Brown and Danaher. But so because it was your first, and it was a drought breaker, you know, it was 1958 when the Collingwood Army last had a chance to cheer like that. So it was a huge day. And, it's a big thing to call a grand final anywhere, anytime. So because it was my first one, that's probably the most memorable. I mean, there've been great grand finals. Of course, 89, the three-peat of the Brisbane Lions. I mean, Michael Voss was just, to me, he's one of the greatest ever as well. Perhaps the greatest leader. There's, you know, you could probably pluck out just about every grand final and pick something from it and say that's the greatest.
You worked with some of the great characters as well, calling football, and everything that goes to wear is you put the facade of total professionalism, calmness and coolness, even if things are going awry behind the scenes. Have there been any moments that stand out to you?
Look, working with Louis Richards was a joy. But I mean, particularly on the Army Reserve Cup with Bobby Skilton, and the three of us got on really, really well. But Louis, I mean, he was... he'd bring a coffee in and then he'd spill it, so all your team sheets that you've done with Texter will all spider out everywhere and you couldn't see anything, and he'd just laugh away. And I mean, little things like that. We'd call games, you know, at the Lake Oval or at Windy Hill, at Moorabbin, which were all great places to call, because in those days you were on a scaffolding with members and whatever underneath you, and and particularly down at Moorabbin, we're in the animal cage. The animal cage was right in front of us. So they were memorable days. And the crowd was really interesting, because the crowd, particularly say at Windy Hill, you know, they'd love Tim Watson, they'd love Simon Madden and all these great players, Danaher and Vanderhaar. And, you know, instead of the crowd at Windy Hill sort of blaming the umpire, you white mongrel or whatever, they'd blame us. So they'd turn around, we're just sitting up there on the scaffold, and, you know, why'd you let them do that? What do you think of that? It's not our fault. So, no, it was great. It was, they were wonderful times.
Sandy Roberts is my special guest in the studio. Racing's open mic. We'll take a break. On the other side of that, I want to talk to you about your Olympic career and your love and connection to racing, some of the horses you've owned and some of the big moments that you've been involved with on racetracks.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Oh, there's a pig on the ground. There is a pig at full forward.
Oh, he's on a lead. He's on a lead. Get the runner out there and pick up the pig. Number four plugger.
Oh, there's a pig on the ground. There's a pig at full forward. is etched in the vernacular of the AFL. 1993, I think that was. And you and Dennis, your old DJ from back in Perth.
Yep, he was almost lost for words. But it's an interesting story, Mick, because the gentleman who took that pig onto the ground was a Melbourne person. He organised it before he left and went to Sydney. He'd found a property that had pigs just out of Sydney. So he flew up there, took a Hessian bag, got the train out to the property, bought a piglet, took it back to his hotel, had a red paint, wrote on it Plugger, and spelt Plugger wrongly, incidentally, and the number 4, then went in to the SCG. There is a side entrance, you may be aware of it, where media can go through and volunteers. Well, he managed to get through there with the pig in the Hessian bag, and next minute you know, the pig is running around at full forward.
And you knew exactly what it was, what type of pig it was. You
could Large even, white land race
you
cross.
You could even tell the breed. You've had a bit to do with pigs?
Yeah. But Dennis was calling at the time, so he had his eyes firmly on where the ball was, which was basically the other end of the ground. Well, I was just having a bit of a look. And he paused and suddenly I saw this pig, so I just cut in. There's a pig at full forward.
What did Plugger think of it?
Not a lot at the time. But since then, he's mellowed and he could see the humorous side of it.
You dealt with all of these legends and superstars. Some of them, like Plugger back in the time, were a little cantankerous. Who was the most difficult footballer you ever had to deal with?
Well, the one thing I found is that the better the player, the more successful the player, the more professional they were and are towards the media. And I found that with all sportsmen. It doesn't matter whether they're golfers or they're tennis players or they're Olympians. The better they are at their craft, the more professional they are. The two that I found really cantankerous, and they're coaches, and they're South Australian coaches actually, was when we started out, and I've spoken to one of them about it already, was Neil Curley, one of the great iron men of Australian rules and a fierce competitor against EJ Whitten. He couldn't stand the media. So he would give you naught. And another one who is a legend in South Australia and a hugely successful premiership coach with Port Adelaide was Foster Williams. But again, Foss, he wasn't big on the media at all. So, But, you know, generally, I think now too, as you would understand, it's all become far more professional. And players and coaches, they attend media courses. They're told what to say, when to say it, how to say it, what not to say. It is far, far better than it was. And what they've got to understand is that every time we're talking to them, we are promoting them and we're promoting their club. Mm. Now, these clubs down the bottom of the ladder, if they don't want... I just couldn't understand it. You know, if they don't want to do it, I said, you're only hurting yourself. You know, we're trying to help you. So I think that has finally changed. And all clubs now can see the benefit. I tell you, the group that was always fantastic, and I did Bathurst for a number of years, was the motor racing fraternity, because they relied so heavily on sponsorship. So if they've got castrol oil plastered all over a cap or on their shirts or whatever, they'll do any interview, anytime, anywhere.
Yeah.
They were absolutely fantastic because they realised how important it was for that sponsorship dollar.
I want to find out how you dealt with those in the racing industry, because you've always had a love of racing. You haven't been immersed in racing. You've been an owner.
Haven't been hugely successful either, Michael.
No. But you've got a long association that will forever live on. Mount Gambier Cup Day.
No. I thought we were going to talk about racing.
1981. This is what
No, happened. 83.
83, was it? Oh,
don't
lest
try and make it.
Lest we forget.
Don't make it longer than it was.
Here we go.
We still have Miss Australia with us in Leanne Cock, and Leanne Dick, I should say. And Leanne, it's going to be very interesting to... we come to the stage now, and that is, I guess, fashions on the field.
That is one of the most iconic pieces of broadcasting.
If you listen to it very carefully...
Your voice wavering?
Yes, it quite fashions on the field. And I was trying desperately to keep a straight face, and she was like a block of ice by this stage next to me. But what people didn't realise was that I had done I'd pre-recorded an interview with her, and we took two races. We took the hurdle and we took the cup, and it was, I think, a one-hour OB, or might have been two-hour OB, and I'd pre-recorded that interview. It went to air. During the break after that, with the hurdle coming up, one of the horses threw a plate. So the producer comes into my earpiece. I'm down near the mounting yard. The producer comes into my ear. He said, look, the race is going to be put back. Can you please find someone to interview just to fill? So I have a look around, and I can say, look, I'm sorry, there's no one here. The only person I can see is that Miss Australia. Well, I've interviewed her, and that's already gone to air. And he said, no, just grab her. Come on, stand by. We're coming back, quick. So I just had to say, come over here, you know. So I was really under the pump, but next minute, you know, welcome back to picturesque Glen Burnie. Still with me is Miss Australia, Leanne Cock, Dick.
And is it true your cameraman, Sandoz, everyone was just on the floor?
Well, no. The general manager of the station was a friend of mine by the name of Tony Phillips. And he, in an earlier life, did a lot of on-air work. So being in Mount Country race meeting and working amongst the crowd, you're always in danger of perhaps losing a wire or a lead or audio or whatever. So he had an earpiece and a microphone, and he was probably 25 metres away, so he could take over if anything happened. Well, he could hear what I said. So after I'd gone, you know, fashions on the field, I looked over to him to take over, and he was on his knees with tears streaming down his face. I was going to get no help from him.
How did you hold it together?
We've seen
some great pieces when you're at Seven with Tim Watson or with Peter Mitchell on the desk, where you just lose it uncontrollably, and Mitch can't read the taps lotto numbers. It must have been a very difficult situation to hold it together.
It was very hard, and even more difficult was because I'd come from the area. Lucendale was probably 3/4 of an hour from Mount Gambier, and I knew a lot of farmers and things like that. Well, there were these blokes jumping off their tractors coming into the racing and just wanted to see me and have a laugh with me. Well, it just went on and on. And then, unfortunately, the way the whole thing got out was that it was on SCS8, which was the television station, but it went to Ballarat as well. And someone was in videotape in Ballarat, and they said, hey, have a look at this. And from there, it went to Gordon Bennett and Gary Fenton. And then it went around the world.
And ironically, Leanne Dick married and became
a Cockerel. Yeah. But she is a lovely, lovely lady. In fact, she sent me a tape on my 60th, and it started off, well, hello, Randy. I mean, Sandy. I'm not very good with names. So she was just trying to get back. But she's a lovely person.
Yeah.
And she took it really well. I mean, you know, it's just one of those unfortunate
one
things.
One of the great bloopers in Australian media. Your connection with racing, though, runs a lot deeper. Your first Olympics, you worked very closely with Bill Collins, and I know you were good friends with him. But you've had a long association as an owner as well with some great mates and people that are very well known.
It actually started, Mick, in Melbourne. Many people will remember the Penthouse Club. Well, in Adelaide, we had our own Penthouse Club. And I did the racing, the harness racing, with a journalist there by the name of Vin Lewis, who was a specialist in racing. And so we'd be out to Globe Derby every Saturday night and bring the red hots to everyone in the Penthouse Club. And so we eventually got a horse called Daisy A Day.
And, a
shocking name and a very average horse, unfortunately. it did nothing, but it piqued my interest. And then when we came over here and I got to know Drew Morfitt very well and became involved, when you're becoming involved with World of Sport and Uncle Doug and Keith Hillier and all these sort of guys that were legends in the racing world. And the first horse we got was a horse called Storm Prince, which was very exciting for us. We went into it with, because we were heavily involved in the golf as well, with Jack Newton, Bruce Critchley and Renton Laidlaw, our two British visitors. There was Drew as well. And so it was a really exciting time. Lee Friedman was the trainer, and it was very exciting because it won, I think, its first two races. And then we opened up the Herald Sun one day, And we saw the nominations, I think it was, for the Cox Plate and this Storm Prince. I mean, there's about 100 horses. And there's Storm Prince. So we had visions of, you know, winning the WS Cox Plate and who was going to make the speech and everything. It never did another thing. It never did another thing. It actually, we took it to Murray one day. And Drew loved his horses. And the jockey, who'll remain nameless, was Storm Prince, had these two wins in the metropolitan area. So we were quietly confident. And the jockey, we said, how do you think it'll go? And I won't say S-H-I-T, but he just looked at us all and said, mate, this will shit him. We love your confidence. Anyway, it didn't. And, you know, when they pass the post and sometimes they won't pull the horse up too soon, you know, they might go another 300 metres. Well, this particular jockey, I think, took it about 650 metres.
He didn't want to come back.
Didn't want to come back. He didn't want to see Drew. But Drew desperately wanted to see him. So that was the end. And I think Storm Prince actually was sold to, I may be wrong, but I think I'm right in saying, to George Moore's son in Hong Kong.
Gary.
And it became the leading money winner in a season.
Wow. There you go.
So, you know, well, their gain was our loss.
Drew would have followed that very closely. And I had the pleasure of having Drew in here before he untimely passed away. But what a great story on the weekend. Kaz, who yes. I know you're great friends with and you subsequently have spoken to, having the biggest win
with
Princess of Queens at Caulfield.
Really exciting. And I spoke to her on Saturday night and she was absolutely rapt. And I think, you know, Drew, if he was looking down there, he would have just said one word, magnificent.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. You've been present at some of racing's biggest moments as well, because you used to do the presentation for Seven's Melbourne Cup coverage, and you were on the stage hosting the presentation when Maccabi Diva won her third Melbourne
Cup. First, second and third.
Yes. Yeah. Did you know the impending retirement announcement was coming?
Had absolutely no idea. No. Nothing had been said. No one hinted anything. And well, the Santics obviously knew, but no, we had no inkling whatsoever. So it was an extraordinary time. And I mean, that, like, we've been so privileged in racing to in our lifetime and in say the past two decades to have a horse like Maccabi Diva do what the Brisbane Lions did and win three back to back. I mean, unheard of. And a crowd of 100,000 at Flemington. And now we have Winx and, you know, we're just black caviar. I mean, we've been absolutely spoiled.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. Just digressing for one moment, because you love your racing, but you're not immersed in racing. We've had a tough period recently, a number of controversies, Darren Weir, the most recent. Has it changed your view, or do you think other people out there's views who are not inside the bubble, or is it just racing will continue to roll on with the good horses?
It's an interesting question, Mick. I was chatting to Matty Stewart outside, and I liken a little bit to Sandpaper Gate. Now, I love Test cricket. Love it. And when this happened, I knew straight away, I thought, this is going to be huge. And now I can take or leave watching Test cricket. And that's sad. When this happened, and I've interviewed Darren Weir, emceed functions with him, and delightful person, you know, I found a really good guy. And I just felt exactly the same. So I think the sport, sadly, will take a hit. But I hope, as I hope cricket does, I hope they both recover. But, yeah, it's not good. And, Matt was saying there could be another storm brewing in racing. Well, that's the last thing the sport needs. So I hope it recovers.
What are some of the biggest sports stories that you've covered or been around, from AFL to Olympics, whether it's, you know, doping, positives?
Well, Ben Johnson was probably the biggest in '88 in Seoul. We didn't have the rights that year, but I went over for seven, and that was a huge story. So that's probably the biggest. I mean, and then we've had big stories here with South Melbourne.
To the Swans.
Going to Sydney. All the talks, Hawthorn and Melbourne, the merger, and Don Scott, I mean, ripping up the jumper. And there have been some big, big stories.
And in recent times, we've had the supplement scandal. I suppose the move from VFL to AFL was a massive move for football. And
the national comp.
And for you as a commentator as well, with the changing of broadcast rights and everything.
Yeah, and to bring in, initially to bring in Adelaide, then to bring in Port Adelaide, Fremantle. I mean, the national competition was huge. And I think, I don't know what your thoughts are, but I'm probably one that believes we should have a team in Tasmania. Now, I know financially it's very difficult, but I just think if we're going to be a truly national sport, you can't exclude Tasmania. I mean, they've given us some of the greatest players the game has seen. So why shouldn't they be a part of it? There have been some huge yarns, and of course, James Heard, Bomber Thompson. I mean, you could go on
absolutely.
And on.
The pinnacle of sport is the Olympics. You hosted and commentated on 11 Olympic Games. Is Moscow your first, where it was pretty much your big career break, the one that stands out, or is there another Olympic since then?
Stood out for a number of reasons, Mick, because at that time there was huge political problems in Russia, and the Eastern Bloc going up against America and what have you. And so the bottom line was that the then Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, said to both the broadcaster, which was the Seven Network, and the Australian team, there is no pressure on you. If you don't want to go, you don't have to. So I think, a number of athletes chose not to go. And as you're aware, nowadays, when you're doing Olympic Games, you take a crew of probably between 250 and 350. We took 49. Mm. So it was huge. That's why, and it was very different. It was unique because it wasn't professional as it is nowadays. Nowadays, you get told 6 months before an Olympic Games, you're doing gymnastics, you're doing whatever. This was very different. We'd go down to breakfast every morning, and I'll never forget one morning when we went down and Ron Casey stands up and he says, "Welcome, gentlemen, to day four. Bill Collins, you'll be doing judo. Sandy Roberts, you'll be doing archery." Well, the only archery I'd ever known was Robin Hood. So, and he actually I gave him a mention because I knew nothing about it. And Bill had to do judo. Well, here's a racing man who went over there to call track and field, and he's told to go out and do judo. So we tootled off together because it was in a similar venue, and we got through, but that's how different it was. But it was, and I was as green as green because I was taken from Adelaide, and it was about day 10 into the Olympics when Ron Casey became ill with a rash, because he did everything. I mean, he managed our team, he organised everything. So they asked me to take over as the host, and it was then that they spoke to me about coming across to Melbourne, and I didn't hesitate.
Changed your career and your life.
Yeah, yeah, and really did.
And I've been lucky enough to work on a couple of Olympics with yourself and the likes of Drew Morfitt and Bruce McAvaney, and you have a lot of fun, a camaraderie amongst the commentators, and there's even a little bit of cheekiness as well. Some fictional characters that might get get named in some sports and names or words that have to be put into certain commentary.
Yeah. Look, we've worked with a number of legends, and the great Helmut Vascher was one of those. Helmut was originally an athlete and then went on to become a quite outspoken coach. And yes, he received he not only did Summer Olympics, he did Winter Olympics as well. He was a very versatile man helmet, and we wish him well if he is listening.
Oh, very good. We're going to take a break. We're going to wrap things up with Sandy Roberts and get some of his sporting highlights, some of the most impressive people that he's interviewed and his favourite sports people and horses as well. That's coming up.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Welcome back to Racing Pulse Open. Mike, Sandy Roberts, legendary broadcaster, is with me. And Sandy, we've been traversing your career, and now I want to get to the parts where we find out what are your favourite moments and your top sports people favourite horse. Let's start with the favourite racing moment of your career and your favourite horse.
Well, we go back away, Mick, because when I was a younger reporter, I was told to go and do a story on this horse that had come across from New Zealand and was stabled down at Mornington Peninsula. And so I went down there, I met the trainer, Snowy Lupton, and the horse, of course, was Kiwi. And I got on extremely well with Snowy, and thought, I'm gonna follow this horse, you know. And history, of course, will tell you it produced one of the great runs to come from last. And so that was a really memorable moment for me. And then, of course, to go back down the peninsula that night and be with them.
Did you party with them?
It was fantastic. Because it was really my first, coming from Adelaide, it was basically my first taste of the Melbourne Cup. So that is a wonderful moment. Just in racing, to be a part of, I think, Maccabi Diva, to be there for the three of them was just an unbelievable achievement by that horse and the trainer and the jockey. So that's a standout. We talked earlier about professionals, and the better they are, the more professional they are. In the world of golf, I had the pleasure of working with Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, Seve Ballesteros, Bernard Langer. Now, people might forget, but all these players would come out to Australia and they'd play in the skins game, which we televised, or the test match. We used to have this thing called a test match. And Nick Faldo would lead the Brits and Greg Norman would lead the Australians. And that's when golf was really, really big. So they were all fantastic guys to be with. So, and then, of course, you know, you can go to football, you can go to
just
tennis.
On the golf, you actually became quite good mates with the Shark back in the day. I saw an unbelievable story that you did with him over in the States, and you went out fishing with him on his big 100-foot yacht. What was it like with the Shark back in
the day? He was fantastic. I actually saw him, met him first in 1976 when he won his first tournament. It was in South Australia. It was the West Lakes Classic, and this big blonde Queenslander came to town and just from then on shook up the world. So I got to meet him then and know him, and he was also very good to me when our son Sam was ill. I mean, he finished one round of the Australian Masters one afternoon, said to me when we got off air, "Come on, we're going down in the chopper." I said, "Where to?" He said, "To your farm," meaning to my farm, which was in the Western District. Sam was there, so we flew down. He played snooker with Sam for probably an hour and a half, then jumped in the chopper and we came back. So that's the sort of things that he would do. He was very, very good to Sam.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And I mean, that's an area we haven't touched on, but that changed your life forever as well.
Oh, it did. And, Greg wore a hat when Sam passed shortly after that. And he wore a hat with Sam's name on it when he played the Masters. So, he was very good. And not just him, but there are other people like Gary Ablett Sr. and Gary Buddha Hocking. Both spent time with Sam in the Geelong Hospital. You know, they didn't have to do that. And that's the sort of thing, and they're the sort of things that you remember for your entire life.
And a lot of that goes unspoken.
Correct.
Of the major stars as well. And
yep.
And I know you were talking earlier saying that those who reach the pinnacle of their sport are a lot easier to deal with, that you find. And you spend a lot of time with in more recent years, Roger Federer, the GOAT. What did you? What were those?
I loved it. I mean, my memory, my fondest memory of Roger, is that when he lost to Nadal, I think it was, in the final, and it was the first time that that Rod Laver was going to be in attendance at Rod Laver Arena when Roger was in a final, and Roger idolized Rod Laver. So he was passionate about winning that final, and he got beaten. And if you remember, he comes to me, the runner-up, Roger Federer, and he comes to me at the microphone, and he just breaks down. Yeah. And so I had to console him and say, look, just hang on, we'll get Rafa over. And
is it true you said harden up, mate?
No, toughen up, princess. He was, but he's been a wonderful. They're the sort of people I'm talking about. Just wonderful ambassadors for their respective sports. You know, we've got some players that could take a good hard look at Roger and
currently
Rafa.
In the tennis world, exactly. The greatest moment of your calling career, Olympics, football, any sport. What's the first memory that comes into your mind?
Oh, Mick, I don't know. I don't know. Look, there are highlights. It was my job, and I loved my job. And
is there one regret you actually never got to call an Australian gold medal?
Yes, and I also loved cricket. I would have loved to have called cricket, but the way the rights were dealt in all my time at Seven, we had tennis, golf, and footy, but we never had cricket. And as soon as I depart, they get the cricket. So that's just the way the ball bounces. So you can't do anything about that.
And the best commentator that you worked with, we know who you learnt your caper from. And overall, who do you think's the best sports person that you've seen?
Oh, heck. Well, I loved Muhammad Ali. Saw him, of course, at the Olympics when he carried the torch and lit the flame. Best commentator? Look, I'm not going to sit on the fence, but there are a lot. And if you're not a good commentator or you're not competent, because of the way the game is nowadays, you'll get found out very, very quickly. Social media, 27 cameras at a grand final, you know, they don't miss a thing. That means the person in the lounge room doesn't miss a thing. But, you know, Bruce has been fantastic for a long period of time. Dennis Cometti's been really good. Of the younger brigade, Anthony Hudson's been doing a fantastic job. Dwayne Russell's a very competent caller. Look, as I said, if you're not good, you'll get found out.
And it's quite remarkable that you were a mentor to Bruce. He followed you through the South Australian mafia and have produced two of the greatest sport broadcasters we've ever seen. We're almost out of time, but the next phase for you, Sandy, now you're going to continue to call on radio. And the last few years, it's probably been nice for you working over at Fox because you've got to work with your son Ben over there
as well.
I did,
yes. It's good having your son telling you to throw to a commercial break or get off. he's done well. He's a producer over there and really does enjoy his work.
And Carolyn, your lovely wife, we'll get to see a bit more of you at home. And you've got your youngest son, Angus, who's doing year 12 and is a budding tennis star as well.
Yeah, he's going well. He's at Halebury at the moment and captain of the school tennis team. So going pretty well. He's got a very tough match this week against Carey, Michael.
And you get very you don't get nervous when you're calling some of the best and biggest moments, but you get nervous watching Angus.
I get terribly nervous. I'm rapt that at most of the schools, there is the main oval is near the courts, so I can just nip across and calm down by watching a few overs of cricket and then skip back to see how he's going. But, yeah, no, he's going well.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Sandy. I'm lucky enough to call you a friend and have worked with you for a number of time. A lot of SMSs coming through. Some of your great sayings from Oh My Hat, Upcountry Punch is coming through on here as well. So you've left a legacy which will live forever. Congratulations on your television career. We look forward to hearing you continue on radio. Thanks for your time this morning, Sandals.
Thanks for having me, Mick. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Sandy Roberts, a legend of Australian sports broadcasting. As we say goodbye, big happy birthday to John Hawkes, who turns 70 today.
Oh.
Hall of Fame trainer and a legend. You would have dealt with Hawksy over the years as well.
And his father and son.
Yes, exactly. So
happy birthday, John.
Tomorrow, we're going to have Amanda Elliott, the chairman of the VRC, in the studio after 9 o'clock. And also, we're going to have a chat to Dan O'Sullivan from the Ratings Bureau. He is going to dissect, give us all of the information on the best two-year-olds in Australia. Fascinating to see what he thinks there as we build up to the Blue Diamond. In the meantime, back a winner. I'll be back tomorrow from 8:30.